Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. On the surface, reverse mortgages might seem like the ideal solution for cash-strapped seniors. You don't have to make any payments, and the mortgage doesn't come due until you die or move out. So it's tempting to tap into the equity of your home. But a reverse mortgage isn't for everyone. We're going to talk about this with Globe and Mail personal finance columnist Rob Carrick. He's going to take us through the pros and cons of reverse mortgages. Then half robot, half human, pairing robo-advisors with human advisors. It's called a hybrid model, and we're going to learn more about these kinds of partnerships from MoneySense contributing editor David Ashton. And purchasing home is a big decision, and with changing regulations, increasing interest rates, and a variety of opinions on the housing market, it can also be very confusing. We're going to talk about how the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation can help. Its chief commercial officer, Romy Bowers, is here. Plus, age 65 is often noted as a retirement milestone, yet more and more young people are cutting that number in half by retiring early. It's called the FIRE movement, F-I-R-E. And we're going to talk about it with the founder of Broke Millennial, Aaron Lowry, about what it means for millennials' wallets. And we're going to look at a new initiative from Commonwealth that's working to establish an affordable retirement plan for those employed in Canada's nonprofit sector. All that is ahead. Let's get started. It could be a solution for some people's retirement savings problems, at least as they work on trying to pay for life in retirement. A lot of seniors are sitting on an enormous amount of equity in their home, but may have trouble paying for groceries at the end of the day. Still, the rise in reverse mortgages raises questions about how they work and who they are, whom they are right for. Joining us now from Ottawa is Globe and Mail's personal finance columnist, Rob Carrick. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Bruce.
Let's start with the terms here. What is a reverse mortgage and how does one work?
Well, basically, you are borrowing against the equity you have in your house. The reverse mortgage company says to you, we will give you up to roughly 40, 50% of the equity you have in your house, and you can take that money, do whatever you want with it. And when you sell the house, you will pay us back what you owe us, and you will keep the difference between the sale price and the amount owing. Now, the thing is that the loan they're giving you, there's an interest rate attached, of course. It's higher than regular mortgage rates, and it's quietly ticking along in the background. So if you borrow, let's say, $500,000, and you let that ride for 10 years, you could owe substantially more than that when you sold. So the question becomes, I sell my house, how much is left for me after I pay off the reverse mortgage company?
Yeah, which, you know, it could might be a significant sum of equity you have eaten up over time. Still, this is something that is really on the rise, up, what, 35% in the first 5 months of this year. Why do you think reverse mortgages have been growing in popularity?
You know what? First, let me put that in a little bit of context for you. Fabulous growth, really big growth numbers for reverse mortgages, but from a very small base. They have been a niche fringe product for a long time. Now, to me, the first sign of something really happening in this sector was when a second company, Equitable Bank, announced they were also going to offer reverse mortgages in Canada. We saw a second competitor to the widely known CHIP program, I think in 2008. They launched about 3 minutes before the financial crisis hit, and they were gone in about 6 minutes.
Right.
Now Equitable Bank is coming in, and I'm thinking finally someone wants to compete for this. That suggests to me something's finally happening here. I think what's happening is, A, seniors are figuring out, I can't live the lifestyle I want to live based on what I've saved. And they're thinking, what is the least painful, at least in their minds, least painful way to up their income and to give themselves more money? Reverse mortgage. And so that's why the numbers are rising.
We're going to talk about the pros and cons in a second. But I want to ask, have you seen a shift in your own thinking on reverse mortgages? Because you've covered this space for a very long time, as have I. And it seems like the cons have surpassed the pros on whether or not this is a good option for the the large set of people.
I'm actually heading in the opposite direction. I used to turn my nose up at them. I mean, it's almost I almost thought of them as sort of as a sign of financial failure. This is like your parachute after you've fallen out of the plane. You pull the ripcord on this thing.
Yep.
But I'm becoming a little bit more open-minded because we have to be practical. You know, if people have tons of home equity and they don't have much else, what are you going to do? You know, you can get a home equity line of credit, but you know how behavior is. People don't want to pay the interest as they go along, which you have to do with your line of credit. And the home, the reverse mortgage is get that money and forget about it till the day you sell. I think there are applications where it is worth considering. But for me, it's a fair thing, not a long-term thing. But I noticed that the reverse mortgage companies are trying to promote these things as tap into your equity and treat yourself, start a new career, do fun things. And I'm thinking, no, it's more for bridge me to I'm selling in 2 or 3 years, but I need money now. That's more where I'm getting sympathetic to them.
Yeah, I get really freaked out when debt instruments are being sold for big lifestyle improvements. I can see that there is a real role in particular for seniors who deeply, deeply want to stay in their home. That seems to be the emotional benefit that most resonates for me. That's another big part of the selling pitch.
I agreed. So staying in your own home is big. You know, a lot of seniors want to do that. And in some cases, it makes quite a lot of sense. I mean, you take a little bit of money out of your home equity using reverse mortgage. You completely retrofit your house. Maybe you provide a little fund for some home care. Could be a very good situation. It may be that you're going to be, it may be that this is going to bridge you. You're going to live in the house for the rest of your life, and your estate can worry about all the details. But I'm with you. Reverse mortgages for fun, for consumption, to buy stuff and things, to give your kids stuff, it's a bad idea. You just don't want to give away your equity before, you know, there comes a time when you know how much you're going to need it. What if you last 15 years in a long-term care facility? You know what? You don't know how that could be quite expensive if you don't want to live in a decent place. You may need your home equity. Don't spend it before you know.
Mm. Some of the other cons. So you mentioned the rate, what, typically 2 times the rate that people would pay?
No, I haven't looked at the spread recently, and I guess the question would be, would a second competitor come in and maybe provide a little downward pressure on rates? But they're a fair bit, I'm not going to say double, but they're a fair bit higher than regular mortgage rates. So if your head's in the clouds about how marvelously low the 5-year fixed rate mortgages are, even now, after some increases, reverse mortgages are quite a bit higher than that. They're more in line with what you thought historical borrowing costs would be. So maybe more in the 5% range, but I'm just going off the top of my head, and I have not checked them lately.
What are some of the other fees and restrictions and other things that people should be aware of so they go in eyes open?
Well, there are some fees to get these things set up. The restrictions are minimal, really. You know what? You can even get these things as a line of credit type of thing now, where you can say, okay, I've got this facility that I can borrow from if I need it, and I'll take this much if I need it, but I won't take any more. They are really getting savvy about making these things super user friendly, super flexible. Basically, so you just get this whole thing set up, and then you know, some people will grab all the money they can and spend it, and others will think, I want it there just for my peace of mind. And if you don't touch it, the interest clock doesn't start, of course. So I think the companies that are offering these things are getting smarter and smarter about it. And I think that also helps explain why the rate of increase on these things is so big. You know what, Bruce? I'm waiting for a big bank to get into this area. I think that would be extremely interesting. And if that happens, that is like the rubber stamp of validation.
Right. And a marketing budget that Home Equity Bank does not have. They would be able to not only market it, but push it out through every branch in the country if they chose that.
Right. Exactly.
Fred Vitesse, chief actuary at Morneau Chappelle, he wrote a book called Retirement Income for Life, and he called reverse mortgages the nuclear option. He's got very clear opinions on what type of situation they can work for, and he admits there are some situations in which it absolutely can be a great option. But one of the risks he highlights is that housing prices might fall and that interest rates could rise, you know, dramatically over time. Maybe not dramatically. Interest rates could rise over time, eating into equity faster. How do you sort of work in some of those more macro factors into your very micro choice?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, a lot of people who are going to be using these things have had their house double or triple in value. So if we have to give back a little equity in a correction, so be it. Now, I know how people's minds think. You know what? If they take the peak price in their head, and anything they lose off that is a loss, rather than comparing where they end up selling at compared to where they bought. Nevertheless, a little bit of a retraction in the housing market, you lose a bit of equity. It's not a big deal if you've tripled your equity. The people who offer these reverse mortgages are very savvy about calculating how much they'll give you because they don't want people to end up with zero equity. It's very bad for the brand, and it's very bad for them. They don't want to run that risk. So that's why they're not even good. You know, you may not even be able to get half your home value.
Just before we go, who is the best second opinion here? I mean, obviously the sellers of the reverse mortgage will have a view. Do you think financial advisors are equipped to provide objective perspective on whether or not this move makes sense?
I think a fee-for-service financial planner is the place to go. You want someone who you can pay an hourly or a flat fee to run an analysis for you of whether this makes sense, how much longer do you expect to live, what do you need the money for, are there alternative sources from it? These people would not sell any products, they would just sell advice. I think that is the place to go, and I would categorically not get a reverse mortgage without getting a second opinion. I think it's that monumental a decision, and I really think you need to think about it hard.
Thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate your insight.
No problems, Bruce.
Rob Carrick, Globe and Mail's personal finance columnist. He joined us from Ottawa to talk about reverse mortgages.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Not all robots are considered equal. There are a number of robo-advisors out there to choose from in Canada, but which is the best at what? Here to take us through his 2018 robo-advisor guide is David Aston, contributing editor at MoneySense. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
So you wrote a pretty detailed piece on the players. There seems to be more and more competition in this space. What were some of the variables that you were looking at as a way to compare the strengths and weaknesses in relative terms?
Well, I think all the robo-advisors tend to have a lot of similarities with regards to the core of what they do. So, you know, the streamlined, paperless, efficient investment process with this access across multiple digital channels. So the core of what they do is pretty similar, but they tend to have little bells and whistles and variations on what they do that kind of can make one particular offering maybe a little bit suited to somebody in a particular situation, and then other people offer, you know, other variations that might make them better suited to other situations.
What are some examples of bells and whistles in this particular area?
Well, one of the examples is some of the, although robo-advisors have this image of being, you know, completely algorithm-based investment options, they actually come with, there is limited access to human advice. And lately, some of the robo-advisors have been kind of adding to that a little bit. So they'll some of them offer, for example, basic financial planning, or they'll have offer a dedicated human advisor. Still limited, but
something.
You'll have a specific advisor dedicated to you on a limited basis. So that's one of the examples.
Some of the names on your list are either owned by a financial institution like BMO or have a very strong relationship with a much bigger institution like Wealthsimple. How did that factor into your analysis? Are there pros and cons to that?
Well, I kind of view that as being kind of neutral. I think that from the robo-advisor's point of view, for example, Wealthsimple having this relationship with Power gives them access to a lot of marketing money, and it really helps them get the word out and expand. And they offer a very competitive products. But I think some of the little guys, maybe they don't have the marketing budget, they can still offer a good product as well.
Yeah.
So I think both the big players and the little players can both be good.
How big is the range on fees? I know they have different ways of doing it. There's sort of the monthly subscription model, and then there's the percentage of assets under management, like almost like a fee-based model. How much different? How much of a range is there?
Well, there's a little bit. Obviously, there's a little bit of a variation, and you know sometimes they come up on situations like, you know, some will have deals if you sign up and it's no fees for the first 6 months and things like that. But I think by and large, the nature of competition drives them to being fairly similar and at roughly the same competitive level. Now there's still, you know, a little bit room for variation. Some of them on the larger accounts make a point of being you know, on the largest accounts, trying to be, you know, a little bit more competitive than the others. But by and large, you kind of, competition forces them all to have pretty attractive pricing.
Was there a standout on the financial planning side? And I ask because the investing part is relatively easy, all things being equal. You know, sorting someone into a balanced portfolio based on relatively, if they've got relatively simple circumstances, that's pretty easy. What about the planning part?
Well, I think basically what you're going to get there is still going to be a fairly basic financial plan. So, and it's really hard to judge one from another without having, like, you know, kind of gone through the process and test driven it with close look at doing financial plans with them. So I'm not sure that there's a real differentiator there between one firm that does do a little financial planning versus another. I think the way to look at it is if that's a little bit of a help, that's a good feature to have. But if like you have a burning need for a really comprehensive financial planning, then probably you need to look outside the robo-advisor and go with a financial planner who's maybe a fee for service financial planner specializes in that.
What are as they do add a layer of humanity or human actual human involvement here. What are some of the things that person could do that the technology is incapable of? Is it talking them off the ledge in a market meltdown? Is it empathy towards changing financial circumstances? What are the kinds of things that a human being is required for?
Well, I think that's part of it. It's both the human empathetic qualities, as you pointed out. If there's a big market meltdown and somebody isn't really confident in sort of figuring out their financial situation, deciding what to do on their own, then it's really helpful to have somebody, a trusted financial advisor that they have a relationship with, that they're confident in the advisor's knowledge. So that's what, one example. So it's the human qualities, empathy, but it's also, I think, where more sophisticated and specialized services are required, like estate planning or tax planning that just have a lot of complexity to them, and those situations are very hard for a algorithm, obviously, to kind of cover all the variations and subtleties that go with those complex situations.
There are a number of entrants, as you point out in your report, but the total assets under management for the whole category still is teeny, teeny, tiny from a market share perspective. Why do you think that is? Why do you think adoption has not been more significant? I know the robo-advisor people out there who are listening will say, wait a sec, our growth in percentage terms is enormous. And that's true. It's that in absolute terms, it's still such a small piece of the pie.
Yeah, well, I think it, you know, for any new concept, it takes a while for it to get going and for people to start to get confident in the process. And it's kind of interesting, Canada's significantly behind the U.S., where I think you're seeing, you know, because they kind of got started earlier and you're kind of seeing a much greater explosion in adoption. It's more because they're earlier in the process, I think. It's probably a natural characteristic of things just take a while to get going when it's a new idea.
Yeah. Well, David, thanks very much for your insight and for also following the sector. We appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Bruce. Thanks for having me on your show.
David Aston is contributing editor of Money Sense, and he is the author of the 2018 Robo Advisor Guide. Coming up next on Moolah La, we'll learn more about the FIRE movement and the impact it could have on millennials' wallets. Broke Millennial founder Aaron Lowry will be here. And later, we look at an initiative from Commonwealth that's working to create a retirement plan for those working in Canada's nonprofit sector. You can email us any of your financial questions, any comments that you have. Our email address is ask@moolahla.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Retirement age used to mean something. For most jobs, you had to be in your mid-60s to hit the milestone and say farewell to the workplace for good. But times have changed a lot, and there is a growing, still small, but growing segment of the population looking to retire early. Way, way early. It's called the FIRE movement, and it stands for Financial Independence and Retire Early. Joining us now from New York City is Aaron Lowry. She's a personal finance expert, the founder of Broke Millennial, a blog and book aimed at helping millennials get their financial lives together. She joins us from Astoria, Queens. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is the FIRE movement exactly? I mean, we're talking retire really, really early.
You are. And it really depends on who you ask. There are so many subsects of the FIRE movement as well. You've got Fat FIRE, Lean FIRE, Barista FIRE. So it goes really all over the place. But the core tenet of the entire movement is people who are trying to achieve financial independence, whatever that means to them. For a lot of folks, it's a minimum of $1 million, looking at the 4% withdrawal rate, so they feel that they can live off of $40,000 for the rest of their lives. And for others, it means more, and for some, it even means less. So trying to achieve financial independence and therefore leave the workforce. Now, the thing that a lot of people have issues with, including myself in some cases, is the retire early part, because a lot of these people leave the traditional workforce, but they still work. They just work in a different capacity.
Mm. Barista FIRE? What is Barista FIRE?
That's one of my favorites. I feel like it's a relatively new term, or at least I've been hearing it just recently. And it's more specific for Americans who are trying to achieve FIRE because, as you all know, our healthcare system is not the greatest. So it's people who are financially independent, but then join companies such as a Starbucks that offers healthcare to part-time employees in order to hack the healthcare costs.
Wow. Wow. Now, this is not a path you have been pursuing, at least not currently, but you almost did. Is that right? Tell me about your story.
Well, what I like to joke about is that there was one time I almost joined the FIRE movement, and I've been a not-so-silent critic, cynic, whatever word you want to use, of the movement. I believe in FI. I believe everybody is ultimately trying to be financially independent. That's the goal of trying to reach retirement. But I am skeptical of this idea that at 35 or less, you could leave with just $1 million, which to some people, they might think a million is a ton of money, but depends on where you want to live, depends on if you want to get married, have kids, healthcare issues come up. There are so many factors here that have not unfolded by the time you're only 35 years old. And I just don't see $1 million, even $3 million for many people, being enough to get you through to the end of your life. But there have been times where I've been seduced by the movement, if you will, because, yeah, it sounds great to, at 35, 40, be able to say, I don't need to earn another penny in my life, and I can just go pursue whatever it is that I want to do in life.
I think that sounds like the worst thing ever in the history of the world. I would wither like a leaf in the desert sun if I retired so early. It would take so much work for me to figure out things to do. Have people factored that in, or is it just that they have great aspirations to have complete sovereignty over their time, an aspiration I do not hold?
And I think it depends on how you consider the word retire. That's the issue that I and a lot of people have with the movement, is that the movement itself is essentially trying to redefine retire and just say that they're no longer beholden to an employer and they no longer need a paycheck. But most of them pivot to do something akin to what I actually do now and be self-employed, rather that's write a blog, put out books, run a podcast, do some sort of other volunteer work, or work in just a completely different industry. That's what a lot of people end up doing. So they're still working. They're still bringing in an income, but they don't technically need it. And that's where there's a lot of gray area around this whole retire part of it.
What is specific to your generation, the millennial generation, that has this idea resonate? Well, I talk a lot about the generational differences, and I think there's a distinction between generations and life stage. And in this case, this sounds like a generational phenomenon, a mindset difference.
Well, I would actually look at the Gen Xers, because those are the big names in the FIRE movement are really Gen Xers.
I guess, because 35 and Gen Xers are 37. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, right. So then that's part of it. But in terms of both of these, looking at Gen X and looking at millennials, I think part of it is, especially for millennials, this idea of having employer and employee loyalty just simply doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, most of us do not have access to jobs that we could stay in until we wanted to retire. Pensions are pretty much a thing of the past, at least in the United States. And I think there's just an inherent distrust of your employer in the sense of you don't know when you could be let go. There doesn't have that same level of security. So a lot of people, whether it's necessity because they're paying off student loans or another form of debt, or because they just don't trust having one income stream, a lot of people have created the whole side hustle movement and have more than one stream of income. And I think that was kind of laying the groundwork for this idea of I can opt out early and take control. And I think that that's really what the FIRE movement speaks to. The other thing that's interesting to me is a lot of people who are the big names in the movement, if you will, are people who are really high achievers. So I often wonder, after the newness of being retired has worn off and you don't have that competitive edge, that competitive drive that you have being fulfilled at work, what's going to happen?
You mentioned the sort of, I don't know, psychographic, perhaps, of people who are pursuing this life. And it is not, in some ways, it is not a particularly diverse population.
Agreed.
Why do you think that? I mean, how do we layer in other issues of people's circumstance? Like, it must seem to, you know, the single mother who's punching the clock, just trying to keep a roof over her head, she might guffaw at the thought of financial independence, retire early. She's probably fantasizing about providing some money for her child's education savings.
I think a lot of the general population guffaws at the entire concept. And I think a big part of the struggle right now is some people who write about it and speak about it are incredibly open about privilege, the idea of privilege, their personal inherent privilege. But the greater movement, I don't think, has been readily accepting of the fact that it isn't a diverse population. If you see a picture of people at a meeting, it doesn't look particularly diverse. And that's something you have to consider. The other thing, too, is the jobs that often get featured as jobs that lead people to financial independence. It's a joke because it's so trite at this point, but software engineer seems to be the number one job that gets referenced in any article right. that is written about FIRE. And that's such a small subset of the population, and not everyone can be a software engineer. So saying, well, just switch your job to something that can earn you more money is not helpful advice to give people.
Instead of focusing on retiring early, one of the things you've written about is your efforts to live intentionally instead. What does that mean to you?
Well, I actually really kind of took this idea from the Frugal Woods, who's a couple who has had a blog for many years. We actually started around the same time about 5 years ago and wrote a book, came out maybe 6 months or so ago, that's Meet the Frugal Woods. And it's about their own journey to financial independence at a very young age in their late 30s. And we have very different visions of what we would want our retired lives to be. They're on a homestead in Vermont. That's not remotely interesting to me. But she, Liz, the writer, talks a lot about this idea of living intentionally and putting money into just what you value. And that's something I preach myself a lot when I'm talking about just how to get your financial life together, spending money on what you value. We get so many messages from the media, our family, our friends, our coworkers about what we're supposed to value. But you need to be very good at boiling it down to what you personally find valuable, and don't let other people's messages get in the way of that. And I also feel that the idea of intentional living is figuring out the lifestyle that you want to have and be open to the fact that that's going to change over time. Mm. And that's another struggle I have with FIRE is there's a lot of conversation about, you know, if you live in a metropolitan area, you're wasting money, you don't need to be there. Simplify, simplify, simplify. But there are values and things that I personally like about living in a major urban environment that would make me not want to go into a smaller rural area, if you will. So
Broadway, that is one, the Broadway.
That is one, the general diversity, the access to pretty much anything you want when you want it, the food, the culture. It just really depends on what you value.
Erin, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. Erin Lowry is the founder of Broke Millennial, and she was here today to talk about the FIRE movement, which stands for Financial Independence and Retire Early. And I think Erin and I agree that we're not headed down that path. Interesting to know in terms of the zeitgeist, but I'm going to work till I'm 102, I think. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. But up next, we'll learn more about the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation and what it actually does. Its chief commercial officer, Romy Bowers, will be here. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Purchasing a home is an important decision that's both exciting and terrifying in equal measure. Changing rules and regulations, increasing interest rates, varying opinions on the housing market, all that can make things really confusing. One name you have inevitably heard in the coverage of the Canadian housing market is Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, or CMHC. What does it actually do? Here to tell us more is CMHC's Chief Commercial Officer, Romy Bowers. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Pretend you're talking to my 8-year-old Abby.
Absolutely.
And tell her what the role is of the CMHC.
So CMHC is a government organization. We like to consider ourselves Canada's national housing agency. So our goal is to make housing choices easier for Canadians. Hmm.
The big product that people hear about all the time is insurance. How does that work?
So we have a mortgage loan insurance product that we sell to Canadians, and the purpose of the mortgage loan insurance, what it does is it transfers credit risk from the banks to the government. And the reason we have it is to reduce the risk for the banks so that they will provide loans to first-time home buyers at the same interest rate that they would to everybody else.
Right. And it's mandatory. If you don't hit a certain down payment threshold, you got to have it.
That's right. It's by law. If you don't have 20% down payment, you got to buy this insurance.
CMHC, as you say, a Crown Corporation owned by the government.
Yes.
How do you think about profit and loss internally?
Internally. So we're not like a private corporation where we try to maximize profit.
Squeeze every dollar out of those consumers.
That's right. Although you know, that's an important part of the economy in terms of people who try to maximize profit for their shareholders. But our role is a little bit different. We try to earn enough profit to cover our costs and to put aside enough capital because, as you know, in insurance, there's always going to be claims. So we want to make sure that we have enough money put aside to pay those claims when they come due.
I have no idea what the frequency would be that people would make a claim on that insurance. How often does it happen?
So it doesn't happen very often. So as you know, in Canada, we don't have a history of having a big housing losses like they did in the U.S. Mm. Knock on wood.
Yep.
And it's a very, very small, less than 1%, less than a half of 1% in terms of the people who default on their mortgages.
And what should people know in terms of the cost here? And we're talking to people who are thinking about buying a home. It's a one-time cost they pay upfront when they buy that house.
So it's based on the value of the loan. So if you think about, and again, it depends on a whole bunch of different conditions, but if you think about 3-4% of whatever the value is, that's what you need to pay for mortgage insurance. But what the banks do is they actually wrap it up with the total cost of the mortgage. So you sort of pay, as you pay your mortgage, you pay the cost of the premium.
Right. So a consumer might not actually see it.
No.
But they should know about it.
They should know
about
it.
Because it may affect when they decide to purchase.
That's right.
Now, the nuance that has changed things a little bit is the arrival of this stress test for people who have a down payment that's less than 20%.
Yes.
They need to adhere to a stress test that they can accommodate rates that are 2% higher than they currently are.
That's right.
How has that changed the dynamic for mortgage loan insurance? Because I've heard the theory that some people are like, well, I'm not going to put all my money into the down payment because it's better for me to get mortgage loan insurance than to have to adhere to the requirements of the stress test.
Yeah. So it's still a little bit early days because, as you know, the stress test took effect only this January and we're just sort of going into the mortgage season. But already we've seen a little bit of a slowing down in our business. And I think people are taking a little bit more time to consider their financial options, maybe save up a little bit bit more money. So we've seen a definite downturn in our business for sure.
I was looking at your debt service calculator.
Yes.
And it looks at housing expenses, all the stuff related directly to housing.
Yes.
But not expenses related to life, like retirement savings, kids' education, vacations, all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
Why not?
Partly because we feel that a lot of that that assessment is done by the banks, you know. So we have a debt calculator to say, like, what's the minimum amount of amount you need to cover the cost of the house. But with your financial services professional, you need to work through what do you actually really need to live.
I wish that were true, and it's not on their calculators either.
Really?
It's one of the things that I find, because and I often talk about the disconnect between what the bank will lend you and what you can afford.
Yes.
How do you think through that kind of question? Because if you look at it, I mean, the banks are concerned about default. I get it. So CMHC.
Yeah.
But oftentimes people are making suboptimal long-term choices because they haven't thought holistically.
Yeah. So I think the advice, you know, I'm not a financial planner or professional, but just think about. You really need to keep track of all the expenses that you need to support your lifestyle. And you need to also think about unexpected things that can happen to, you know, that you might need to pay for, you know, and it could be, you know, the birth of a new child, schooling expenses, who knows, right?
All
but you need to think about all those things. And can you really afford this mortgage? Maybe it's better to have a slightly smaller house, or maybe you need to wait a little bit longer to make that down payment a little bit bigger.
What are the other parts of the business that people might be less familiar with? So mortgage insurance, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of public policy kind of stuff that occurs out there in the world. But what do people know less about?
So one part of the business I'm responsible for that I'm sure no one knows about is called the securitization business.
Oh,
so,
am I going to need a nap when you're done describing this?
Okay. I'll say it very to your 8-year-old, the way I've explained
please.
It. Is that basically we take the insured mortgages, and what we do is we package it into securities and we sell it to investors on behalf of the bank.
So wait, isn't that what happened around the financial crisis? I thought we were done doing that.
That's right. That's right. But the one big difference is the mortgages are insured. We have rules to regulate the type of mortgages that go into it. So we think we have pretty good checks and balances to make sure some of the, you know, the bad things that happened during the financial crisis in the U.S. that don't happen in Canada. So that's part of my job is to make sure that to run the securitization program, but in a responsible way, so we don't put taxpayers' money at risk.
Are there any other pieces? There seemed to be an educational mandate that I didn't fully appreciate until I went onto your website.
Okay.
Anything else that you're focused on?
Yes. So we have a whole bunch of housing economists who work for us, and one of our pieces of our mandate is to really educate Canadians about the housing market and about the mortgage, decision making and financial literacy regarding mortgages as well.
Where do you play on this massive question of affordability? It's such a big deal. I mean, we have listeners coast to coast to coast, but in major cities, affordability seems intractable.
Yeah, so it's a huge preoccupation for us. So I don't know if you've heard about it, but there's been a new national housing strategy announced by the federal government. It's a $40 billion investment over 10 years. And one of its primary objectives is to improve housing affordability for Canadians. As you know, you're living in Toronto, you know what it's like. It's really hard for middle-class Canadians to afford a home here.
And what role does CMHC have in that? Is it insurance on less conventional models like multifamily, or is there things that you would do that would focus on that?
Yeah, so in the commercial business, which I run, we have a multi-unit insurance business. So we provide, we try to make the cost of financing for developers of multi-unit housing cheaper. And the advantage of this is that it creates more purpose-built rental in hot markets like Toronto.
Right.
And we feel that helps in part to solve some of the affordability challenges. But in the non-commercial part of our business, we actually are very actively involved working with all levels of government to actually create affordable housing units for Canadians that I would consider maybe more vulnerable Canadians. Maybe they don't have as much money or as much economic wherewithal as other Canadians. And we try to make sure that they have a place that they can call home. So that's a very, very important initiative for us.
Good work. Good. You're doing good work, Romy.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
It's good work. Romy Bauer is the Chief Commercial Officer with CMHC. Stay with us. Coming up next, we'll look at the Common Good Retirement Initiative, a first-of-its-kind portable retirement plan for those working in the nonprofit sector. And we'll talk to Romy Bowers about the Moolala questionnaire. Also want to mention our book club questions. You probably usually read fiction in your book club, which I think is fantastic and totally dishy, but you could put down your Danielle Steele and pick up a little Moolala, and instead, book number one has a discussion guide for book clubs at the end of it. You can go to the library and get some copies and try it out. Stick around. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Planning for retirement is very important for individuals, but not all employers have the resources to offer some sort of, you know, group plan. This becomes very apparent when you look at the nonprofit sector, where about 50% of employees don't have access to a workplace retirement plan. Commonwealth is working to change that number with their Common Good initiative to create a portable retirement plan for nonprofit sector employees. Joining us now is Commonwealth's founding partner, Alex Mazur. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Where did this idea for this retirement plan come from?
Well, you know, this has been an issue of concern to leaders in the nonprofit sector for a long time, who, you know, care a lot about issues of decent work, financial security, economic security, more broadly, and for their own workforce. And so there have been discussions within the sector for a long time about this issue. There have been a variety of initiatives. And this really came out of some discussions that we had with leaders in that sector, foundation leaders, organization leaders, folks that are known for, you know, getting things started in that sector. Probably started, you know, some time ago. And at this point, we're at the stage of exploring whether it's possible to create a nationally portable plan that's, you know, sustainable and can cover, you know, a decent set, part of that sector.
How will it work?
So the basic idea is that it would be set up as a nonprofit. It would be governed by a board of directors, and it would be a plan that, in theory, any employer in the nonprofit sector could access if they wanted to, and that also any worker could access, whether they are an employee or a freelancer. The idea is for it to be flexible and to try to meet the needs of the organizations in the sector that don't have coverage today. So that means, you know, flexibility on contribution rates, portability, a simplicity and low cost. But the basic idea is to have a plan that's a kind of standalone nonprofit entity that's portable across the country within the nonprofit and charitable sectors.
What needs to happen for this to really take hold and be a force? Because one of the things that I assume you'd need is some sort of, I don't know, foundational stakeholder that, you know, Ontario Teachers Pension Plan has in its employee base, or OMERS has in its you know, union members or whatever. What's the who's the starting group here, the evoked set that's going to make it go?
Well, I mean, the founding group of people that are working on it now, there's four foundations that are involved. There's a steering committee that's being chaired by a gentleman named Alan Broadbent. There are right now there's a Champions Council of about 12 nonprofit sector leaders. And so that's, you know, the coalition right now that's behind that. And we're supporting the effort from a technical and project management perspective. And we basically have 6 months to see if we can get enough employers willing to sign up for something like this that we could offer it and run it on a sustainable basis. So it's really about identifying employers, whether they're small, medium, or large, who would want to offer something like this. And as you know, in order to run a good retirement plan, there does need to be some scale. It doesn't have to cover anywhere near the entire sector to get that scale, but we do need a critical mass.
You've started to articulate some principles that would be important for this initiative to focus on, things like inclusion, affordability, accessibility. How did you come to those principles, and how tough was it to come to those principles?
Well, I would say the principles are based on two things. One is our understanding of the needs of employers and workers in the sector, based on a lot of conversations we've had and, you know, knowledge that we've gained from working with the other partners on the project, who are really people who know the sector extremely well. And the other thing is evidence around what works when it comes to high-quality retirement plans. There's a lot of really good evidence that a well-run, well-governed collective plan can generate a lot more value for money than a do-it-yourself approach to retirement. And so we try to ground the design in evidence and also, you know, the needs of the constituents that are meant to be served by this.
What is required on the part of the employer? Is it necessary that they fund some sort of a match, or really do they just have to say, yeah, you can email our people?
Yeah, so the proposal is designed to be flexible. So the idea is if you want to make a match and you're able to make a match, that's obviously fantastic. And that will mean more retirement security for the workers and more incentive to participate on their behalf. But we also know that a lot of nonprofits have unstable funding, limited financial means, and some of them just want the ability to offer a plan to their employees even if they can't contribute themselves. So that's an option as well. The contribution rates are basically totally flexible depending on the needs of the workers and the employers.
If this is successful and assets do start coming in, what sort of model do you think you would use on how that money gets run? So with, you know, obviously with OMERS and teachers, they're very sophisticated. They've got billions of dollars. They do a lot of that work in-house. Would you envision that there would be an investment board internally, or would you outsource that function to money managers?
Well, I think, you know, at the beginning, a simple approach probably makes the most sense. You know, we look at plans like, say, the Nest plan in the UK, which started with a very simple, low-cost, passively invested, well-diversified approach. And so, you know, we think an approach like that would probably make sense, although ultimately the decision about who manages the money will rest with the board. Over time, you know, more things become possible on the investment side. And one opportunity we think is quite exciting is that a plan like this could help members in the post-retirement phase as well figure out all of those decisions around how do you turn your nest egg into more of a stream of income, which is a really complicated phase that not a lot of group plans, you know, provide assistance to the members with. And part of the idea of this plan is people would stay in the plan after they retire, and they continue to have that fiduciary protection and the benefits of scale in the 65-plus phase of their financial life.
You mentioned Nest. Where is Canada compared to other first-world countries on pursuing this type of initiative?
Well, I'd say we have excellent public sector plans. So if you're working for government in a full-time...
You're good to go.
You're good to go. I mean, we're all familiar with that. You know, I'd say the CPP enhancement was a step in the right direction. I'd say where we've been not as good is coverage for private sector and not-for-profit employees that are not part of a big employer. And so we've seen a pretty dramatic shift away from higher quality plans to maybe lower quality ones, and also employers getting out of the retirement space altogether. Mm. But the good news is there seems to be more, you know, innovation around this now. I'd say the leadership that the nonprofit sector is showing on this initiative is one example of that. And, you know, hopefully, you know, in the years to come, we'll see more of a focus on the uncovered parts of the system and the market.
Interesting. Well, Alex, best of luck to you on this.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for your interest.
Appreciate you joining us. Alex Mazur is we're talking about the Common Good Initiative, an effort to create a portable retirement plan for the nonprofit sector. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. It is our series of questions loosely based on the Proust Questionnaire related to money. Our guest, Romy Bowers, she is the Chief Commercial Officer at Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. So, Romy, just the first thing that comes to your mind. How would you describe your money personality?
Conservative.
Was it always conservative? I mean, I can see, given your role, that you'd be conservative. But were you the person who, you know, saved your allowance as an 8-year-old yourself?
You know what? I think as I've grown older, I've become more conservative.
More conservative?
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know what it is. It's actually not. It's not a great thing. But you know, I think I'm just more cautious, and I think it's partly my professional background because I used to work in risk management at a large bank.
Oh.
So you know, in risk management, the glass is always half empty a little bit.
Right.
So.
You wouldn't cross the street without wrapping yourself in bubble paper.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh.
Absolutely.
Who was one of your money mentors growing up, someone who you learned something from or aspired to be like?
You know what? I don't know if it's a money mentor, but definitely a life mentor was my grandmother, because she's I'm half Japanese. My grandmother grew up through the war in Japan, so she was always very careful about making use of everything and not wasting anything. So I learned a lot from her. And it's not about money, but just about life and valuing stuff. Right?
Do you have any particular not wasting money habits that you continue from that legacy of your grandmother's? I will admit, just to give you some room here, I rinse and save all Ziploc bags. And I will clean tinfoil and fold it and save tinfoil as well.
Okay, I'm not as good as you, I don't think.
Well, I don't know if it's good or bad. It is. Do you have anything? What about elastic bands?
But I'm a big follower of Marie Kondo. You know,
Spark Joy. Yes.
So I'm all into not being a consumer. Like only saving up to buy things that I really love versus filling my house with junk.
What is one guilty spending pleasure that you have? What are things that you really love?
There's two things. Two guilty pleasures.
Oh, I wish I could guess. I have one guess, but I don't know that. Okay. You tell me, and then I'll see if I'm right.
I have to say I love spending money on experience, like vacations. So that's one, right?
Okay, expenses.
And the next thing is I also love clothes. So I love especially like Canadian designers in Toronto.
But not fast fashion. You would not be going to H&M.
I've been going to this one boutique for many, many years, and some of the suits I buy there, I've been wearing them for like 10 years,
right?
Which is pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
That pays out over time.
Yeah.
What is one place you would love to go and you think, oh, geez, that's an expensive vacation, but in the land of experiences, I want to get there before I die?
Oh, I would love to go to Antarctica, I would say. Yeah.
That is not an insignificant spend.
No.
Yeah, and not an insignificant travel.
Absolutely.
Duration to get there. What was your worst financial mistake? Aside from leaving the private sector and going to work for a Crown Corporation, which I'm sure was a really dumb move from an income standpoint.
Oh.
Have you made no mistakes?
You know what? No.
Have you ever had your car get towed?
Yeah. You know what? You know, I actually spent a lot of time in school, right? So I always think.
You have too many degrees.
Yeah, I have too many degrees. So I always think, you know, maybe I should have started working right away.
Right.
You know, so
just right out of high school.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'd be exactly where you are today if you had just come right out of high school to where you are right now.
Perhaps,
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that was good.
Yeah.
When do you plan to retire and what will you do? I know it's decades away, but when do you plan to retire and what will you do?
You know what? My plan is not to retire.
I'm hearing that more and more and more and more.
I'm hoping I can just sort of reduce my hours of work and just sort of slowly fade out. That's my plan.
If you were to win $25 million, aside from setting up a scholarship for affordable housing or something very virtuous like that, what would you do with your money?
You know what? I have no idea. Like, I think I would probably help out my family. That sounds a bit virtuous, but
it does. Well,
yeah.
You kind of seem like a virtuous person,
you
except for the clothing habit,
which is that.
Listeners, you wouldn't believe what she's wearing now. It's haute couture. She just got off the runway at the Met Gala. It was like a $25,000 bedazzled. No, I'm just kidding. What is one financial behavior that if you could snap your fingers and change in Canadian society at large, you would do just that? What is the one thing, if you could change it, you would do it?
I think debt levels in Canada, I think it's too high. I think it's this the culture of having it now. You know, I think that's something that it's not good for your finances, but it's also not good for the environment as well.
All that. Romy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Romy Bowers, Chief Commercial Officer at Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation with the Moolala Questionnaire. That is our show for today. If you want some more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca. You can also go to iTunes or wherever you download podcasts and download the full hour-long podcast version of the show. You can write a review. You can subscribe to the next episode, whatever works for you. We're on the radio, but I do a lot of TV. If you are into TV, go to cityline.tv, and you can check out segments that have aired over there. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great day.